guardian.co.uk.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Writing is hard, even for authors who do it all the time. Less frequent practitioners, the business executive with an annual report to get out, the graduate school student with her thesis proposal, often get stuck in an awkward passage or find the muddle on their screens, and then blame themselves.
This is a short book because most books about writing are filled with bullshit. Fiction writers, present company included, don't understand very much about what they do. Not why it works when it's good, not why it doesn't when it's bad. I figured the shorter the book, the less the bullshit.
My name is Dalali, and I am a writer.
My name is Amelia, and I am a writer.
It's all about encouraging you and developing you as an individual writer.
It's just given me a taste of lots of different types of writing that I've never even thought about before.
Writing to describe sounds easy. The questions are straightforward, like describe someone you know well or describe a favourite room. But there is a knack to getting it right. Firstly, you need to give lots of details.
I keep on writing, even though I might feel I'm wasting my time. Experience tells me that what you need to do, even if you really seriously think you're just filling pages with no effect whatsoever, the thing to do is to carry on and get your story finished.
42 years ago, the novelist Malcolm Bradbury set up the UK's first creative writing course at the University of East Anglia. The rest is history. Or is it? There are now more than 400 undergraduate courses in the subject and innumerable graduate programmes, as well as classes run by newspapers and publishers. But how many literary careers ever materialise from all this activity? Do such courses develop individual flair and lead to successful careers? Or are they, as one commenter said, in response to a recent article on the subject by Rachel Cusk, trading in false promises? There are cheaper ways to feel less lonely, wrote Agent Graves. Richard Lee has been into the classroom to find out more.
But in a way, the time in this is... reflects, you know, his kind of emotional state as well. He's a preteen or he's a teenager.
Yeah.
Because of that, in another world, really, as they are.
Yeah.
The fact that we get lost inside his head and everything that he sees.
And again, I think this is quite literary writing.
There's an upstart in schools of humanities up and down the country. Academies still reeling from the introduction of departments of English literature only 250 years ago now find themselves invaded by a motley collection of poets, novelists and writers of all stripe, teachers of creative writing. But can you teach creativity? John Sutherland, Emeritus Lord Northcliffe Professor of Modern English Literature at University College London and veteran of numerous literary prize judging panels, isn't so sure.
Everyone is supposed to have a novel inside them, for instance, and you're probably a poem as well. And certainly, you know, that may be true. I mean, most of us have life narratives, but it's probably not a very good novel and perhaps not even a very readable novel. It's very, very difficult to write a novel which is publishable. In the research I've done in publishing history, which is mainly in the 19th century, the ratio is about 9 unpublished to every 1 published. And of every 1 published, there's an even smaller minority which are any good. That's to say 11,000 novels were published last year in the UK, and I would guess that sort of, you know, probably about sort of 10/11 of those are crap. You had to be very, very dubious, very sceptical about whether, you know, people have that talent, or more than one talent, of course. Now, I've written lots of books of a critical kind. I've tried to write novels, and it's very instructive because I can't do it. I can't make characters move. I can't make characters live. I can't get situations interesting. Yes, somehow it's just not my knack. not in fact to throw a bucket of cold water over aspiration. And one of the good things about creative writing classes is that they do usually start from an enthusiasm, a love of literature. But actually, because you love it, and because you can read it intelligently and sometimes with a high degree of critical response, doesn't necessarily mean you can do it.
There are fewer hang-ups about teaching creativity outside the world of literature. No one would dream of suggesting that you can't teach painting or acting or even composition. For the singer Mary King, the idea that teachers can only help creative artists with the technical aspects of their chosen discipline is just ridiculous.
It is fairly well understood in academies of music that you have to balance technical achievement and accomplishment with a sense, if you like, of poetry, of drama, and of communication, because no matter what, you are not just singing a load of technical scales or, you know, perfect roulades. You are communicating stories for the most part as a singer. Mostly you're using words and you're trying to add an extra layer to those words.
Is it just because of the name, something that's got the word creative in it and people get nervous?
Do you know, I think that might have something to do with it. I think sometimes people think that creative is a bit of a word like talent. If you've got talent, you don't need to do hard work. And I think creative is another such a dangerous word that it implies no discipline. It implies some sort of freedom. Well, of course, it's both things. It's technical accomplishment. And of course, in terms of writing and in singing too, you've got to have something to say. So good.
The novelist Toby Litt, who teaches on the creative writing MA at Birkbeck, answers critics with a dose of empiricism.
No longer so any kind of theory. I would say, okay, I'll just give you something that one of the students wrote in week two, and I'll give you something the same student has handed in 12 weeks later, and you can see in works on that level that person will be writing a lot better. And it's quite possible that they will have gone, maybe not within the 12 weeks, but over the course of a year or 2 years attending an MA, from someone whose work you would put aside to someone whose work you would seek out. There is a growing competence in writing. I think if you judge a short story competition, you will see that there's a vast number of very competent writers out there, quite a few of whom will have gone through creative writing courses. And I think that competence is guaranteed. People will get better as storytellers.
If worries about teaching creativity are just a red herring, if teachers acknowledge creative writing courses can only provide what Litt calls the Newtonian physics of fiction, then what's the problem? Some worry that creative writing courses flatten the individuality of students or sap the daring of teachers' own work. But for Sutherland, creative writing courses are selling an impossible dream.
I chewed my words very carefully here. I do think that sometimes institutions, they do sell a package which is mislabeled goods. That is to say, there's the implication, take our course and you will come out a creative writer. That, in my experience, may work with courses which are highly selective. I'm very much in favour of what you could call hybrid courses, such as they have at Warwick, where in fact you do English of the old-fashioned kind, and at the same time there's a creative component. And it seems to me you can see a fruitful oscillation between those two. You know, doing it gives you a greater respect for those that do it well. But I do feel that there is an exploitation of a sucker's market. I understand where everyone is coming from, but it does make me very uneasy. As with everything in life nowadays, it's caveat emptor. I mean, the purchaser should beware before, in fact, putting up to £30,000 into getting, as it were, an education on how to write a novel.
Right, so we're going to turn now to the first of our stories that you read before. So we're going to look at Duplicate or Duplicate by...
Litt and his colleagues at Birkbeck stress that a creative writing course is no shortcut to literary success or even publication. When I talked to students at Litt's Birkbeck course, at first they seemed admirably level-headed about the prospects of a literary career. Dave Wakeley worked as a librarian, a session musician, and a web developer before starting to work as a business blogger 4 years ago. He's pretty clear about what he's trying to get from a creative writing MA.
The aim is to at least feel capable of writing and completing a novel at the end of the course. There's a sense of reward and fulfillment just from doing well. And if I come out of it feeling like a more capable or more fulfilled human being, and that's as far as it ever goes, that's fine too.
Mary Ballard says she's spending the money she'd put aside for a house on the course. She has equally sensible ambitions to write something she would feel proud of as a personal achievement.
I'm doing it mainly for enjoyment rather than to further my career. I suppose that the dream would be able to be in the writing and publishing world, whether that is a writer or not, I'm not sure.
Jo Stones talks in a similar way of focusing on improving her own skills, but scratch the surface and the dream is there.
For me, the main benefit of doing this particular MA is really studying and practicing and learning the craft. So in terms of hopes and dreams, I would really, really like to work as an author, as a writer, writing novels.
Angela Shoesmith, who's working on two novels, isn't at all worried that the course at Birkbeck might make her any less original.
No. I mean, because what we're learning is a lot of mechanics. And I think the people that come to this course can already write good dialogue, they can already write good description, they can already write good characters, and they have good voice. But it's putting all of those ingredients together into a complete work, which I think is, well, for me personally, what I struggle with.
According to Bullard, the feedback students receive from their peers helps each one find their own literary voice.
From what I've experienced so far in my creative writing courses, there's a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about the different ways in which people write. We've only been doing the course for a month or two. Already, you could read something and think, oh, I think I know, where that's come from. There's definitely no a suggestion that anybody is trying to be like anybody else, or that Toby, our tutor, is trying to change the way that we're being creatively.
I thought it was so witty and so catty and really vicious the way this is dealt with, and just the way that Vanessa is really set up, and I think was so well observed with some of these little things of, well, thanks for jumping in, it's really kind of interrupted. I thought it was really, really well handled as well. It wasn't just good ideas, so I thought that was really excellent.
Litt's colleague at Birkbeck, the writer Russell Kellen-Jones, suggests the expansion of creative writing courses has done far more than improve the general standard of British fiction.
Well, it creates a literary culture of its own. And my view is that 20,000 students up and down this country doing creative writing courses are reading, and they're buying books, and they're reading things that they did not know existed. We do not look at the kind of business opportunities that some writers see fiction being. You know, we look at good literature. The job of the university is to identify and then preserve good literature. And we pass this on to students.
But do creative writing courses rule out the quantum physics of true creativity? Those moments when writers squeeze impossibilities out of the stuff of literature?
No, I believe craziness will always burst through in one way or another, right?
If you go up to the language department, it's just on the first floor.
Sure. Look round the shelves of many bookshops, and any evidence of craziness is hard to find. But according to Forbes' Jonathan Rupin, the unstoppable rise of creative writing courses in the UK can't account for the blandness of contemporary literary culture.
I do think there is a certain homogenisation of literary culture in Britain, but I'm not sure that I would place the blame with creative writing courses. I think there is a little more caution in terms of taking on new writers. Authors have to be seen to be a commercial prospect as well, and publishers are now, unfortunately, ever quicker to drop an author after a book or two rather than giving them a chance to develop. And the sort of thing that gets coverage does tend to become increasingly homogenised. And so people do end up resorting to reading the same authors over and over again. It is really tough to be a debut novelist. There are some amazing books coming out right now which are just dying a horrible commercial death, and it's really quite saddening as a bookseller to see a book that, you know, you might have read a few months before publication, you were excited to see it arrive in the shop, and then 3 months later you look at it and realise you've sold maybe one copy and there it goes, and that book's life is over now.
Literature is struggling in an increasingly hostile marketplace. For Julia Bell, a novelist and poet who also teaches at Birkbeck, Creative writing courses can offer a shelter.
What I'm interested in my teaching is the individual, and I'm interested in making them all into the kinds of writers that they want to be, whether that's a commercial novelist or a literary writer or a poet or a short story writer. Whatever kind of genre that they want to write in is okay with me, but they need to find that place where they're writing at their best, and I suppose that's what I'm trying to get the students towards. I think it's good that we teach the short story, because I think as a literary form, partly, I think creative writing courses keep it afloat. And also the commercial value, the relationship between writing and commerce is very difficult and tricky. I think that what's happened is that a certain kind of literary culture has retreated into the universities and has found protection in the university, and I think that's a good thing. And I also think short stories are a bit like poetry. People who really get them write them for the pleasure of it, and they're not worried about making money out of it. They just enjoy reading them for their own sake.
Belle's more equivocal about the effect teaching the course has had on her own writing.
It's definitely slowed me down. But I enjoy it, so I don't think of it as being an either-or. Hunot Dyer said it uses the same muscle as writing, and I know that he was teaching at MIT, and it took him 10 years to write a novel because of that. I think it's also protected me, because I see other writers that I know really struggling to make a living sort of from book to book, living from hand to mouth, and I just am not the kind of person, maybe I'm not brave enough to be able to do that. But it allows me also to try out lots of different forms. I have the safety of being able to not have to make lots of money from my work, so I can be more experimental, I guess. So in some ways, it's been a real blessing.
Belle's colleague, Russell Kellen-Jones, is another writer-teacher with no illusions about the economic realities of literary fiction.
My view is that writers all tend to do work. You know, it's a pro-am game in terms of money. A lot of writers now teach. In my past, I've been a journalist, I've been a book reviewer, and I found, to some extent, that kind of writing, journalism, if you like, was more interfering of prose narratives that I was also writing as a novelist than teaching. I suppose the one thing that you have to be mindful of is reading not very good students' manuscripts, how you somehow create a firewall around them when you get to your own text. You don't want your sentences to suddenly have the punctuational problems that, say, students' writing have. I mean, hopefully that doesn't happen.
Authors with any literary ambition always risk having to sing for their supper. But Toby Litt doesn't worry creative writing courses are guilty of trading off student dreams of literary stardom.
Well, if the dream is being a writer, then anything to do with the material circumstance of being a writer is secondary. If the deal is being seen as a writer and taking the social position of someone who's successful as a writer, and you're not all that interested in the business of sitting at a desk or engaging with language, then you're not going to do it anyway. Even if they did get past the first book, they'd realise that I have to do this again and again. And essentially, that's what the job description is. It's being on your own with words. Maybe 50 years ago, there wasn't an expectation that someone could write anything like a literary novel and make a living. Malcolm Bradbury sort of was the one of the first generations who might have seen his students doing that. What came along afterwards was a kind of boom in feeling that the novel could sell enough for the publishers to pay those authors, enough for them not to have to do anything else. And that seems quite cozy now.
Now, what shall we do?
April Granger singing for her supper in that report by Richard Lee. With me now, Patrick Keogh, founder of the Guardian Masterclasses and of the Faber Academy. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Claire.
And publisher turned agent, Claire Alexander. That's a gamekeeper-poacher relationship.
I turned so long ago, I almost forget I was ever... Does that poacher or gamekeeper?
I don't know which is which. There's a question.
I've never known.
There's a question. Patrick, you obviously believe in these courses. Tell us what they offer people.
Well, I think they offer so many different things to lots of different individuals. I mean, some people attend these courses because actually it's just a way of expressing themselves. Other people attend these courses because it's a way of meeting like-minded people. And for others, it's the room of one's own. It's really kind of finding a space within a very cluttered and busy life to write. For some, it's a return even to a passion that they potentially explored when they were younger, but then actually got diverted off into another profession. For others, it's an occasion to tell a family history to grandchildren that they may not be around to see. I think these courses are very, very varied.
What proportion ever go and get published?
I don't know the proportion offhand. There's certainly a success rate of people that come through these courses and go on and get not just success, but major success on some occasions. I mean,
such as?
I mean, S.J. Watson for me is the one that, you know, in recent times came out of the Faber Academy course, and he was writing a book there that he was developing over this 6 month period, and it went on to be hugely successful. It sold in 40 countries around the world, but you know, the course was really the start of that journey for him. It wasn't the end of it, and the feedback he got from his tutor Richard Skinner at the time, but also from the group, you know, he cites in the book as very, very valuable. But I know also his relationship subsequently or post that course with Claire Conville, who worked very, very hard on several drafts. Everyone's called Claire. Put him on that road towards publication, and obviously the rest is history. He's gone on and you know, been a number one bestseller in the
350,000 copies in paperback last year, something quite extraordinary.
Absolutely extraordinary. And the film being made now, produced by Ridley Scott's company and starring Nicole Kidman and Colin Firth, and goodness
Claire,
knows who else.
You're nodding very enthusiastically, but don't you, as an agent, can you tell when people have been on creative writing courses?
No, I think you can tell a bit more in America, because I think there's a slightly different sort of culture about teaching creative writing in America, which is very much a teacher and pupil relationship. I think there are many, many different ways of teaching creative writing in this country. And actually, I think the Faber and the Guardian Academies have sort of democratized it a bit, because I was interested just now in hearing that these are people who've had previous lives who may have always wanted to write, and so, you know, they're getting their time now to write it. Maybe a young person doing an MA. You know, I see all sorts who've spent years at universities or months or evening classes. I don't really mind how they do it. I think the important thing is to take themselves seriously as a writer, to have their family and friends take their intention to be a writer seriously. Some teachers are very inspiring, some are not. Very often finding a community for yourself is one of the great wins. So I was having lunch this week with somebody who was at UEA many years ago, actually. Her first readers are her group of fellow students, and they're incredibly supportive of one another. So I think there are all sorts of different things that can come out of this.
Do you think that there's an extent to which publishers are outsourcing the work of developing writers?
I think they outsourced it long ago. I think, you know, it's, you know, I would say this, but I'm not the only agent who was once a publisher. And quite a lot of editors became agents. And I think that there are some terrific editors in publishing houses. So I don't want to pretend there are none, but there are fewer. And if you talk to American publishers, they're particularly rude about the fact that English publishers rarely edit. I don't think it's editors' faults, by the way. I think that's to do with what, you know, what their role is valued by the management, who want them to buy good, you know, books that will sell and sell them. Nobody can demonstrate that an editor makes a book sell more. So better is a sort of complicated idea that creative writing courses might be about, and I'd like them to be about. The thing I hate is when I go and talk to a creative writing course and everyone says, well, what's selling in the marketplace? I think you go on these courses to be a better writer, and the marketplace is a whole other thing.
Patrick, one of the commenters on the Guardian website, who I quoted earlier, did point to the expensiveness of it and said it's an expensive way of curing loneliness. If you go through three terms of the Guardian course, it's going to set you back how much?
Well, I think that
£12,000 or something.
Well, I think that it's an investment. And it's an investment in the same way that people kind of go on holidays or they decide to buy a car.
£12,000 worth of holidays a year.
It's a lot of holidays, but it's about, I don't think it is really that expensive. And I think that people go into it with their eyes wide open. I think also a lot of people decide to do something less expensive first quite often. So they'll go and explore a weekend course, which, you know, you can do here at The Guardian for, you know, they start at £39 and yes, they go up to a couple of £100 to do a day course or a couple of days. But you have to remember the group size is very small. The people that you're being tutored by are absolutely wonderful writers, very often prize-winning writers and indeed highly acclaimed, not just by places like The Guardian and other news organisations, but also by their peers.
I think there's another economic impact of all of this. Sorry to interrupt, but that concerns me a lot. A lot of authors, even prize-winning authors, are not getting the advances they once got. So actually, one of the things that I bless all these courses for is that very good writers can earn some extra money teaching. We paid bigger advances. Now, you know, you're either J.K. Rowling and you make millions, or it's £5,000.
But it's not democracy, really, is it, if you have to have £12,000 at your disposal in a given year?
I'm going to dodge the question. A lot of people save up for these types of things. So what they do is they make decisions about their life and their lifestyle. They kind of say, I'm not going to do this and I'm going to do this because actually it's something that I really value and that I really want to do. It's a staggered commitment. We're not always saying you have to pay £4,000 on day one of registration for these courses. You know, you can pay a deposit and then you can pay the rest in instalments. So, you know, we try and make it manageable for people. But yes, indeed, it is still an investment.
So it may be like the cruise of a lifetime or something like that.
The cruise of a lifetime or that one opportunity to really give it one final shot. It's a passionate indulgence for some. It's a career kind of progressive thing for others. For some, it's just a fantastic experience.
Is there a difference between the ones that are accredited, the ones that are inside the academy and the ones that are outside the academy? You've done both, haven't you? Because you have a UEA accredited course.
Yes, exactly. And I think that it's good to make the distinction between the two. I mean, the ones that we do in conjunction with the University of East Anglia are accredited and validated by the university. So they're looked at through two different prisms. One is the university prism of academia. So all the courses have gone through the various quality assurance mechanisms of the institution and have been, you know, it's been decided by the institution that these can be validated and successful candidates who complete the submission process at the end of the course, which is marked and then double marked and then externally moderated, can go on and receive a certificate or diploma that is validated by UEA. Some of the short courses don't obviously have that. But what they do have, and this is what The Guardian, I think, brings to this side of things, is that it's a looking at what actually writers who want to just concentrate on a particular work, what they need as well. So there's two angles to it. There's an academic angle, but there's also a kind of practical angle about focusing entirely on one person's individual work and the progression of that work over a time frame, whether that's 6 months or 9 months. And the two things, when they come together, can be very, very powerful.
Claire, you brought up the difference between America and England earlier. Talk a little bit about that, because there's been quite a lot of criticism, particularly stateside, of the homogenisation of prose.
In the US, you know, everyone always wants to go to Iowa, and you can sort of tell somebody who's been to Iowa. And I think, you know, there are movies that are about inspirational teachers. I think they have this model of the top-down, you know, inspirational figure to be taught by Ray Carver, and then you all want to write like him. I don't think the English teach like that. I can't explain it, but I think it's not, or maybe it is occasionally, but rarely, I'd think, here.
How many of the clients you represent have been through creative writing? What proportion do you think?
I would say that of the fiction I represent, well, I do a lot with UEA because I go and talk to them every year. And a lot like me, so that's quite nice. So I would say I probably 25% of my client list, but that leaves 75% who didn't. And I have known somebody, just to put the negative, I can think of somebody I did take on who then went on one of these courses and lost their mojo. And that can happen too. It can be too, you know, certain courses can be too brutal for people and they can lose their confidence or they can be with other people who perhaps they think are better practitioners. So it's not all joy and light, but I think in the UK there is a lot of choice from doing a weekend to doing a year to doing, you know, PhD, and they're all a bit different.
I interviewed Kazuo Ishiguro a few years ago, and he said the big difference was what you learnt was whether you were prepared to sit in a room by yourself day after day after day and write.
It's about discipline. It's one of the things that's very valuable about these courses. It's a regular commitment. And I think a lot of people who don't take writing seriously, but kind of who do want to write, lack discipline. And actually, the writers that I've, you know, been around over the years and who've had the privilege of speaking to all talk about this in some shape or form. Now, some work great first thing in the morning, some, you know, in the small hours of the night. But ultimately, they all sit down at a regular time every single day or every other day, and they go about their craft like we come to work.
And even having the craft is not enough, because obviously you need the fairy dust, and only some of them will have the fairy dust, but you have to have the craft.
What do you think of when you hear the term figures of speech? Probably you think of metaphors, similes, or maybe idioms. I like to think of these as the salt and pepper that spice up words. But as you know, sometimes, even with salt and pepper, food still tastes bland.
The first draft is very much an acquaintanceship with the characters. And as I say, often their dialogue, their speech patterns develop during that draft. They don't start that way. And the character who's speaking at the end of the play, on the last pages, often has a completely different speech pattern to the one that started, you know, 70 pages earlier. And I will then go back on a second draft.
Wise words there for anyone considering whether to spend their pocket money or their redundancy cash on training up that inner writer. I did meet one graduate of the Guardian's UEA Masters who refreshingly said she was delighted to have done it for its own sake and had no illusions about becoming a best-selling novelist. There are, however, other routes, not least self-publishing, which has been one of the big success stories of the last year. Among the writers who've chosen that route is Hugh Howie, who published 7 novellas online before landing film and publishing deals for Wool. It's a dystopian thriller in which humanity is condemned to survive in an underground silo. What, though, was Hugh doing before he struck gold? Asked Alison Flood.
You know, I was a bookseller, and I kind of lived in a situation a lot like that. I was in Boone, North Carolina, and there was, you know, snow on the ground, and I would write while stuck in a dark conference room on my lunch breaks, and so it was very easy to sink myself into that world. But it was always a dream to think that one day a story of mine would sit on a bookshelf, but I certainly never thought it would come about like this.
Had you done any creative writing courses or anything like that before you started writing Wool?
Only the prerequisite English classes I took in college, and I never did manage to get a degree, but college is really what turned me around from being a physics major to an English major and studying what I had always enjoyed as a reader, but studying it on the creative side. But I didn't go through an MFA program or study creative writing. It's just something I did on the side for fun for many years.
So you weren't tempted to take that kind of give it a go with a course route or anything?
It was a dream, but you kind of get dissuaded by the statistics, and you know, you don't want to disappoint your parents by chasing an artistic pursuit. But I never gave up that dream of creating fun worlds just for friends and family and a handful of strangers. Certainly never thought it would lead to this sort of audience.
Will is coming out a bit later this month from Century, but when you originally set out to write it, was it just going to be a short story, a novella?
Yeah, I had the idea for the story for about 5 years, and in my head it was always a novel, but I was too busy with other novels to devote the time to this story. So after writing a short story called The Plagiarist, I really fell in love with that length, longer than a short story and shorter than a novella. And I thought, well, I'll just purge this idea and get it out by releasing it in the same vein that I had done The Plagiarist. It was just on the regular Amazon store. It didn't go through editorial to become a Kindle single or anything. It was just a 99-cent story. Didn't do any promoting, just threw it up there and got back to my novels. And 3 months later, this little short story was outselling everything else I had published at the time.
So that's when you realized you had a bit of a hit on your hands then?
Yeah, I figured this was my 5 minutes. I better take advantage of it. So I stopped what I was writing, much to the chagrin of fans of this other series that I have, and I had a novel 95% complete. I stopped what I was doing and started writing the rest of the Wool series, and it's just been a whirlwind. That was not quite a year ago that the last in the series came out. You know, I've had to quit my day job just from time demands, and I've never had a release here in the States, so I'm kind of living vicariously through readers who are sending me pictures from Australia, and I just got someone in Tasmania sent me pictures of Wool on Bookstop, and I'm having to live through that because I've never seen it myself.
So how many copies did you sell as ebooks when you were just doing it yourself through Amazon then?
Over 400,000 copies in the last year, which is mind-boggling.
And was this just selling it bit by bit, kind of section by section?
Most of the sales have been the entire book, the combined omnibus. It's cheaper that way, and you don't have to wait and download the books in between. You get the whole thing. It's a 500-page novel, basically, for $6 US.
The first section of the book ends in quite a bleak way. Well, I don't know if I should give this away. You have the sheriff of the silo deciding he's had enough of it all, and he's going to go outside into the outside world because he believes there might be something more out there. And then it ends. I mean, in a way, it's such a perfect ending to that story. Was it odd deciding then, I'm going to go back to it, I'm going to keep this story going, I've got to make a whole world here?
Yeah, and it's the power of crowdsourcing, really. I had no plans on continuing that story, but the reviews and the emails were just overwhelming for saying, like, we love this world, we want more stories in this world. So I had to take what was a difficult ending point and figure out how to generate a larger story from that. And there's so many readers who think the first part is the best part of the story, and then
I'm one of those readers.
Yeah, and then I read all these reviews where people think that, just one came up yesterday where someone thought the whole first 100 pages were just boring, and then it took off and they loved it from there. So I think maybe being inconsistent with the pacing helps in that not many people hate the book, because there's something. And one half of the book is going to appeal to a different type of reader, whether it's a contemplative, relationship-based reader or an action, thriller, suspense-type reader.
So you're appealing to everyone.
Accidentally, because it was a serialized release, I felt like I could change the tone and the style with each story, and it really worked as it was being published that way. And what's amazing is how well it's worked as a novel since. People have really just gobbled this thing up, and the emails and the responses I get to it are just unbelievable.
What do you think made your book, or the first part of your book when you put it up, take off in particular when there's so many thousands and thousands of books self-published out there?
No, I get emails all the time. People ask me, how did you do it? If I knew, I would make it happen with every one of my books, and it doesn't. I think you can do a lot of post hoc reasoning where after the fact you can try to point to what it was, but I think there are a lot going in its favor. I think it's a compelling story that has a non-traditional ending, and it has strong characters and a short space. People were able to finish it. It worked with people's lifestyles now, where you can read the whole story in, you know, a lunch break. I think the subject matter, which I thought was too dark to be commercial, somehow was written at the right time.
It's all about dystopia at the moment, isn't it? Everyone wants a good dystopia.
Yeah, and we see at the moment, but you look back at, you know, Ray Bradbury and 1984 and Brave New World, you just have kind of a steady stream of people, I don't know, seeing little hope in the future. And that's not who I am. I'm a very optimistic person, but it certainly seems to be what readers are drawn to.
So what made you decide to sign up with a mainstream publisher then? You were doing so well all on your own.
The reason I signed up with Century is because I didn't view overseas as really someplace that I had penetration already. And they were going to be able to expand my reach into places that I couldn't. I can do print-on-demand books here and get them into bookstores, but I couldn't do that in Australia and England. So it just seemed like a natural fit. I continued to do exactly what I was doing here. It was one more foreign publisher.
And I think you've got a physical book publisher now in the States as well, haven't you?
Yeah, in the UK, they have all the rights. They took over the digital and physical for non-US English rights. But here in the States, we held off on deals until we got a major publisher who would take just the print and leave the digital alone. It's being touted as really a breakthrough sort of deal because publishers are loath to do that.
I'm really intrigued to know, having a book that has sold so many copies as a self-published novel, what changes, if any, a publisher has made to the manuscript they've been given?
Exciting changes, not just the small grammatical and house style. Of course, with the UK, I had to change the vocabulary to reflect Queen's English and get the language back to its roots, you know. But also, I worked with this great editor, Jack Fogg, who saw where putting the stories together, we needed more foreshadowing for some characters and scenes that happened later in the book, earlier. And deciding how to tackle that, I ended up writing a completely new chapter that we inserted into the original book two, that's now my favorite chapter in the whole book. It was really, really neat having someone else's eyes to say, this would make it for a stronger story.
So you think it has improved it then?
Oh, absolutely. The book today is, I think it's a stronger book than it was when I released it. The changes aren't so crazy that people who read my rough draft couldn't have a conversation with people reading the book coming out tomorrow. But people who've read both versions just love all the little changes they made. And I have that relationship with my beta readers, and my mom and my wife, who are my first readers, they make suggestions and I make changes, and it's always for the better.
Would you still want to have done it the same way from the start? And do you still see self-publishing as a viable route for new authors?
Oh, absolutely. I think self-publishing is the way to start your career. It's not the end-all, be-all, but I am benefiting greatly from having put out every book that I wrote and just keep writing instead of concentrating on querying and going to conferences and networking and trying to get that first book published. I put it out on my own, was able to buy copies off of its sales, and then by the time I had 7 or 8 books out there, one took off, and now I have a backlist that sells brilliantly just because it's already available. They're not manuscripts in a drawer. They're out there for people to read.
And what would you say to people who turn their noses up at self-publishing?
If you stick with what's in the bookstores and what the publishers are giving you, there's a chance that you'll find what you're used to. If you go exploring and you read the samples and you listen to the people curating these wonderful indie voices, you're going to find unbelievable books that are different from anything else out there. I think it's just a treasure trove, and it's never been a better time to be a reader, I think.
Hugh Howie talking to Alison Flood. Well, I'm convinced, but are you? I'm sure you have your own ideas and comments, so do write them on our website. If you've come to us through iTunes, you can find us at guardian.co.uk/books. There's a podcast button at the top of the page. And if you haven't already, can I urge you to subscribe so you can easily listen in each week and catch all the extra editions we pop in from time to time, such as our book club interviews. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll be looking at crime writing in our day and back at the birth of modern policing in the 19th century. But for now, my thanks to Claire Alexander, Patrick Keogh, Richard Lee and all his merry cast. I'm Claire Armistead. From me and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/Guardian Audio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
Downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.